Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to Radio Islam International. And as promised, we bring you the Conscious Consumer, our installment on matters related to finance. We have with us Brother Muhammad Hafiji, who is going to take us through the segment each week, inshallah. And we're going to be dealing with, like I said, matters related to money and finance. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, Brother Muhammad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Aba Anisa, and to all the listeners of Radio Islam International, and JazakAllah for having me.
JazakAllah khair for being with us, because I think this is an important facet in any person's life, and I think in general Muslim women like myself, we tend to not get too involved with that unless it has anything to do with groceries, clothing or the children. So inshallah we're going to learn some wonderful ways of saving and using money in a better way that's more efficient and going to cause and have much more saving in our lives, and hopefully bring about some barakah as well. So we're starting off on ways to save on grocery shopping. Now that's the perfect thing, I think, for all the ladies listening in today, and hopefully some of the brothers who want to grab some tips.
Indeed, Afanisa, the topic of saving for groceries is important to one and all, young and old. And just to cite some basic figures here, you know, the average grocery bill of the ordinary household in South Africa is sitting anywhere between 3,000 to 5,000 rand a month. Which is quite significant enough. And together with that, soaring inflation or even fuel costs is forcing us, or many individuals, many citizens of the country, to adopt more stringent budgeting practices in our day-to-day lives or in our day-to-day spending patterns, you know. To respond to your specific question of providing basic tips for saving, I just have three simple tips, and many individuals probably have these hacks, many other ways of doing it, but for purposes of our discussion, I just suffice on three. The one is to inculcate a habit of buying merchandise when they are in season. The second is to avoid shopping when hungry, and the third is to avoid or minimize being brand loyal. Now, if you just allow me to expound on each of these three. In terms of buying in season, the reason why it is so important is because if merchandise is bought when it is not the appropriate season, it is in all likelihood merchandise being imported. And by virtue of being imported, the price of that specific merchandise item is likely to be much more expensive than anything else which is in season.
Mm-hmm, makes sense.
The second reason is that if you buy or inculcate a habit of buying things which are in season, it is more likely that the quantity of that merchandise will be in greater supply, which naturally brings down price. So mm-hmm. From an economic perspective, by virtue of having quantity, the retailer is able to provide that merchandise at a better price. Now, just for listeners' benefit, there is a seasonal fruit and vegetable chart for South Africa that is available on our Twitter handle, and I can make it available upon request. The second aspect I talked about was the aspect of avoiding going out and shopping, grocery shopping, on a hungry stomach. And the reason I say this is because many a time when consumers go out shopping on a hungry stomach, that second brain is making the decisions, you know. The second brain being the tummy there. And many individuals don't make the distinction between the aspect of hydration, lack of or being dehydrated, and hunger. Mm-hmm. According to studies, up to 37% of ordinary human beings just make it fail to make the distinction between dehydration and hunger. So they mistake dehydration for hunger, you know, and they end up purchasing more things or more than was expected or budgeted for. As it is, so there are two distinct aspects. One is the aspect of going and shopping hungry, and the other is going shopping properly hydrated. These are two separate distinct habits which need to be inculcated in order to avoid purchases which were not intended or even unnecessary. And the third aspect I talked about is the aspect of avoiding being brand loyal. We should not be surprised how much companies put into the aspect of packaging. So packaging is a large part of the decision in terms of promoting merchandise, and we should not be surprised at this. This is why it is important for consumers to inculcate a habit or move away, make a shift from being too brand loyal. And I do understand sometimes being brand loyal is synonymous with quality, but it's not in all cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like for instance, when you buy the brands like the Pick and Pay no-name brands, you're basically getting good quality. I mean, I've used some of those items and I see no difference between the branded stuff and like if you're looking at sugar or, you know, the general things that you use, they're basically coming from the same place and the manufacturing process is the same. So there isn't really much of a difference in the quality of the product. It's just that the boxes or the branding or the packaging is slightly less attractive than you would for a brand name product.
Precisely. As you said, Apanisha, the thing is, in many cases, the actual producer of the merchandise is the very same producer of the branded one. Just that a different deal is struck between the retailer and the producer of the merchandise. And as a result, you find the packaging is a bit different.
Well, that's, you know, pretty interesting. And you spoke about hydration, and that really, you know, is so important because we don't actually make that connection oftentimes. And you find that you, especially when you have children and you go shopping with them, you find that they are, you know, they get niggly, they start crying because you think they're hungry and you're buying more food. And generally we go into the takeaway places to start buying, and those are pretty expensive, and that adds to your grocery bill or takes away from the important stuff that you should be buying on your grocery bill. So that's pretty interesting, I think. Are we moving on to the next topic, or do you have more
We can proceed.
Okay, so inshallah, we're looking at why is it so difficult to save. I'm totally interested in this because I find that to be very, very difficult as a single mother, one. Two, because of the high cost of living.
Indeed, many individuals in our country, not only the Muslim community, find it exceptionally difficult to save. And for purposes of your question, I'm just suffering on three basic reasons why individuals find it difficult to save. The first of the three reasons is what we call learned helplessness. The second reason is that many individuals struggle to imagine their future self. And the third reason is what is an emerging term in accounting and finance. It is called malleable mental accounting. I'll explain each of these three in a bit of detail.
Okay.
So the first reason why individuals find it difficult to save is due to learned helplessness. A person by the name of Martin Seligman was the first to study this condition, where an individual conditions himself or herself to believe that they cannot change their fate. Even though the individual is in a position of control, over time, the individual believes that they cannot help themselves. So simple things like a person feels like, I don't have enough income. A person just continuously sends this kind of message to their brain, which is so ingrained that even despite the individual reaching a stage of control and having sufficient to save, they just assume to or continuously remind themselves that I do not have enough income to save. You know? Or things like, I tried really hard to stick to a budget, and just too many emergencies have come about, and they continue to derail me, you know. So that learned helplessness is what captures this kind of mindset. Now, in terms of how to deal with learned helplessness, one of the many ways of doing it is to focus on successes of the past. So if an individual has some basic track records in the last 12 months maybe of having saved some portion of their disposable income, focus on that and build on that. So say, you know what, last month I managed to save 100 rand or 200 rand. Let's build on that now. So you're building on success and trying to recondition the mind, send a positive message to the mind or brain to make a shift and start saving. So this is what learned helplessness refers to. It's a state where an individual continuously reminds himself that they cannot do something, despite being in a position of control. And simple statements like people perceive themselves to not have enough income, or having tried to stick to a budget in the past, but it just didn't work, you know. So that's what learned helplessness refers to. The second aspect is, yes?
No, go on, I'm listening.
So the second aspect is the aspect of how individuals struggle to imagine their future self. You know, so when it comes to saving, we're almost talking about saving for the future when you are more dependent on that income and you don't have a stream of revenue or fixed employment or something. Mm-hmm. So that's the context of saving. Now, mm-hmm. it becomes so important to perceive our future selves because of what is emerging in finance and economics at the moment. It's referred to as longevity risk, where globally individuals are projected to live longer than expected.
Yes.
Which means that your work life will end and you will have a longer period of time to sustain yourself. So the person by the name of Keith Chen is a behavioral economist. He carried out this interesting study on whether there's a correlation between languages and planning for the future. And you'll be surprised to find out, Bernie, so that he says that his conclusion in this academic paper is that languages which do not make a distinction between present and future, languages mm-hmm. like German, Chinese, futureless languages, you know, they don't make the distinction between future.
Uh-huh.
Individuals of that language actually have a better propensity to save, and versus individuals or languages where there's a distinction between present and future. So, and the rationale behind it is that when a person is of a language which makes the distinction between present and future, then the person perceives future to be very far. Something that I will get there one day, you know, I'll get a better job in the future, or maybe I'll get some windfall, or someone in my family will pass away, and I'll get a, you know, inheritance.
The
future concept is so ingrained in the mind, the mind is wired in that way. So the language actually has a correlation with how individuals save. So this is the aspect, the point I'm trying to make regarding the struggle we have to imagine our future self. And mm-hmm. how should people deal with this? The most simplest way is to look at people around you. Look at people around you who are not in a very favorable condition in their old age. This will give you an idea of how important it is to start inculcating a habit of saving. So that's the second concept, the ability to or the struggle to imagine our future self. And the last,
really interesting.
The final one, I found this particular behavioral economist, Keith Chen, is someone I follow quite regularly in terms of his academic work, mm-hmm. purely because of his wide acclaim in terms of the academic arena. He said, if you allow me, I can just concept of why people find it difficult to save. This is the concept of what we call malleable mental accounting. It's mm-hmm. big words, but very simple concept. The concept is that there's a difference between how the mind carries out accounting versus the actual number crunching of accounting. That's what we refer to as malleable mental accounting. So let me give you simple examples to understand what malleable mental accounting refers to. So let's say a person gets a tax refund from SARS. Mm-hmm. That tax refund is maybe, say, the tune of 5 to 10,000 rand. And the individual perceives that they've made a huge saving. And naturally, they would say, okay, where else could I spend the 5 to 10,000 rand? So they start looking at other things which were not really necessary. Rather than channeling those funds towards maybe some retirement planning or some other kind of saving, the individual would engage or indulge in some kind of consumer purchase, you know. A similar example is like where a person wants to, let's say, purchase a very expensive, an ordinary computer. And they were budgeting for 15,000 rand, and now you find out, the store has got a discount, and they're giving a discount of, like, bringing down the price 2,000 rand, you know.
Yeah.
So the malleable mental accounting basically is now deluding a person in terms of believing that I made a saving of 2,000, I could spend that 2,000 somewhere else. And rather than channeling that difference to some other saving, the 2,000 is then spent on or splashed on some other consumer merchandise. So this is what the concept refers to, and how individuals can deal with it is to redirect that amount to saving, really automate the process. You know, where you say, okay, I'm going home, and the first thing I do before I do anything else is take the saving I've made and rather channel it towards something more productive. So just to summarize it, the three reasons that I've surfaced on in terms of why individuals find it difficult to save is first, learned helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
The second is they struggle to imagine our future self. And the third is malleable mental accounting.
really, really interesting. I think, you know, that's so relevant when you sit down now and listen to someone explain it to you. It's all about mindset, because basically that's what we need to change in order for us to be able to actually see things from a different perspective.
Indeed, you'll be surprised how much of study is being done in terms of blending psychology with economics and finance, and these are developing or evolving in such a way that behavioral finance is now becoming a discipline on its own. Just how human beings behave is something worth studying and using it for the benefit of developing economic and finance policies.
Alhamdulillah. All right, that was very interesting. I've made mental notes, and I've made notes that I can remember all of this as well, because I need to start looking at ways to save. But the next topic you've chosen is, can a person plan for retirement if they start a bit late?
Most definitely, Apanisha. There's no such a thing as an individual starting to plan for retirement and it's too late. There's always room for improvement, and it's never too late to start saving or planning for one's retirement.
Yes.
If you'll allow me, I'll just start with a basic riddle. You know, the riddle, and this is from another author, I can't recall his name now. He says that, you know, he starts off his article by saying that there are three birds sitting on a line, you know, and two of them decide to fly away. How many are left? So in response, obviously, some would say maybe three birds are left, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some would say one bird is left. And the response to the riddle is obviously that the two birds merely decided to fly. They didn't fly. So that's exactly and precisely how what our approach is regarding retirement. We have an intention to do it, but we don't really make that step and actually start planning, you know, meaningful action towards planning towards or retirement. So in my specific case, I'm just looking at what I want to share with your listeners today is just the issue of here's a simple math rule to apply when it comes to planning for retirement, no matter how old you are and how late you started, right? Here's a simple rule. You calculate, step number one is to calculate your annual expenses that would be applicable on the first year of retirement. So let's say a person is planning to retire at age 55. And in that first year, you're projecting your expenses to be at a specific figure. Obviously, it might be a bit less from the current because you might not have school fees and university fees or whatever it is, but it might be a bit less. So you've got to take that into account. So you've arrived at this figure that what your average expenses would be in your first year of retirement. If you multiply that amount by 4%, you arrive at a specific figure.
Mm-hmm.
That figure is basically the amount you need to have in your position from the day of retirement. Now, if I just rephrase it, allow me to just rephrase it.
Okay.
The question in academic parlance is, how much could a person withdraw, what's the maximum percentage they could withdraw in their first year of retirement such that there is sufficient funds remaining for the next 30 years?
Okay. Wow.
That's the academic question that has been in the arena in these past few years.
Uh-huh.
How much could a person? What's the maximum percentage one could withdraw in the first year of retirement, such that the remainder is sufficient for another 30 years?
30 years.
For another 30 years, and the conclusion they've arrived at after rigorous study and mathematical computations and stuff, academicians have come to this conclusion that the maximum percentage that could be withdrawn in the first year of retirement is actually 4%. So let's look at an example just to simplify it for one and all, right?
Okay.
So a person projects that the annual expenses for the year from the day of retirement would be 400,000 rand.
Okay.
So 400,000 to sustain oneself for a year, which equates to about 33,000 rand a month, right?
Mm-hmm.
You take that amount, 400,000, and multiply it by 4%, or if you don't want to multiply by 4%, you divide by 0.04.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The conclusion is 10 million rand, which means that this individual needs to commence retirement with 10 million rand of savings.
Sure. many people reach that amount at age 55.
Not many people reach that amount, but I want to take the opportunity to emphasize that look around you. How many people without this kind of mathematical computation and this level of planning are still surviving?
Yes.
There's a plan of the Almighty in place. This is just science which is in place to facilitate. If someone can manage to plan in this way, by all means you do it. If you are not in a position to plan in this way, the Almighty is there, and people around you, you've probably, you know, someone listening will say, you know, my uncle and my grandfather and this one, they are living with no savings, you know. It does happen, really. Those are things we it's part of our belief system.
Yes. But it's scary when we think about the number of people that actually retire with very little in their bank accounts, and many, you know, end up being rely on the pensions that they're getting, either state or their company pensions that they earn, and their conditions of living aren't always at the standard that they were used to, which, you know, creates other problems for them.
Most definitely, the whole idea of being dependent on or reliant on anyone, even if it's the government, it's too daunting to think about, you know.
Yeah.
And in my specific example here that I've cited, I'm looking at, I'm projecting 33,000 in a month to survive, which I think is an amount which is about necessary. It's not even living a luxurious life.
Yes.
33,000 is a basic life. 20 years from now, if a person is aged at 30, 20 years from now, 33,000 is basically nothing. So,
nothing.
So just try and apply the rule just to get an idea. I think doing the math is just to give you an idea of what your future planning should be like. So if you'll allow me, Abhanisha, I just want to reiterate the example one more time. I know figures are difficult to capture when it's on radio. So you're basically projecting what your annual expenses would be for the year. And in our example, we're using 400,000 as an example, which equates to 33,000 per month. You multiply by 4% or divide by 0.04, and you arrive at a figure. This is a figure which is mathematically tested as the amount one needs to have in possession when starting retirement, such that if they withdraw 4% per annum, this amount would last for 30 years.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. It's not as difficult as one would actually think it, if you put it in, you know, as you've explained it. So, but it's still quite daunting to imagine the way people live today. And like you said, you know, it's obviously, whatever happens is by the will of Allah, but still we can make efforts to save, and we've, you know, dealt on that subject as well. So I think, you know, many people out there, especially people who haven't started looking at their retirement, need to actually start doing that, because with the way things are at the moment, with the economy changing, ever changing, I think it's very, very pertinent that we really look at that if you want to live comfortably.
It's globally, longevity risk is a global concept now, and if you look at academic papers being written, there are now ways being sought to deal with this whole issue of people living longer than the past.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty interesting and scary all at the same time. All right, and then the last one is insurance houses. Are they really helping consumers? Okay. You know, we grow up with this perception that insurance is something positive in our lives. You seem to have a different perspective.
Most definitely. You know, as you said very correctly there, that by and large, most individuals are in some way or the other involved in conventional insurance. Let's say insurance in some form, either it's conventional or the more Islamic alternative nowadays, right?
Yeah.
I'm leaving that discussion aside for now. I just want to appeal to the mind in terms of how ordinary people view and perceive insurance houses. So here's what I'm getting at. We normally perceive that, you know what, in my hour of need, when I'm in some kind of crisis situation, I'm just going to call my insurer and say that, you know what, I've had a motor car accident, a collision, or there's been a break-in at my home, and this is what happened, and the insurance will process my claim, you know. So what I'm trying to say here is that if you really look at what is happening in our lives today, there is more information regarding crime situations that is available and at the disposal of insurance houses is this very same level of information is not available to the state. So let me just clarify what I'm saying here.
Yeah.
When you and I, when we experience these tragedies of life,
yes.
we report to the police and just say crime happened and just write down some affidavit and that's it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the scientific approach adopted by insurance houses, we give them minute detail regarding our specific experience. So we'll say, it was a laptop that got stolen. This was the value of the laptop. This is the place where it got stolen. This is how it got stolen. So they've got what we call in econometric terms is they've got rich data set regarding
mm-hmm.
any given crime. And the richness of that data set is not, it doesn't come, I mean, the state information doesn't come close to what level of detail insurance houses actually have.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue here is, in many parts of the world, in Scandinavian countries, in the US, insurance houses are actually helping consumers make better decisions. What they do is they take this large bundle of big data,
yeah.
make it available in the form of infographics and infographics that interact with the user. So you, mm-hmm. if you're going to a specific area, you can look at the infographic, you can tap onto it and say, okay, this place here is a parkade, it's a boomed off area. But in the past 20 days, there have been so many crime incidents, and you could mm-hmm. make the decision to park elsewhere. But the appeal I'm trying to say, make is that the same is not happening with insurance houses in South Africa. The
okay.
same level of information is not being made available to us as consumers who are paying and giving our loyalty over, but the same level of information is not coming from insurance houses for our benefit, given the crime situation that is prevalent
yes.
in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that is my appeal. Insurance houses are, in my view, currently not assisting or helping us the way they should be. And the power is in the hands of consumers to make sure that insurance houses rise to the occasion and decide to use this massive amount of minute, rich data set for our ordinary consumer benefit.
Wow, I'm totally blown away by all of this information. When I initially said we need to do something on finance, I didn't really take into consideration the psychological aspects of how finance really has such a big impact. And then, you know, some of the stuff that you've just told me, we don't even think about it on a, you know, daily basis. I mean, people go in to do insurance today, they sign all these forms, they feel protected, and that's it. We walk away without even thinking about these things. And yet, all of that information can be used for your benefit.
Most definitely. And it's not being, if you think of your personal example, when have you ever encountered an insurance house telling you where's the best place to park your motor vehicle or where's the best place to buy a house? They don't do that. It's unheard of in South Africa, where this practice is gaining more traction in other parts of the world other than South Africa.
Well, I think, you know, conscious consumer, I think that's the perfect name, because it's really waking me up with regards to all of this information out there. And I'm really grateful to have heard what you've, you know, said to us today and learned from it. And I hope that the listeners in future will be tuning in to get that kind of information, because it's so pertinent to us as consumers. I mean, there's never a day when you can say I'm not a consumer, because we're always buying, purchasing or using money in some way for some service or product. So here's all the information at your fingertips, being researched and given to you. And alhamdulillah, I think, you know, that was excellent. I'm really, really, for want of a better word, blown away by all this information. I like facts and figures, so obviously this is like really important. And I think many people out there, especially the older people who are so much more, you know, setting their ways with regards to looking at insurance and all those kinds of things, even the way we look at retirement. There's a lot of new information out there that we need to look at as well. And younger generations have to start looking at saving and how best they can get into the retirement thing so that they can save for their futures. As you said, people are living longer lives, and we have to take care of that.
Most definitely. Anissa, from my side, all I want to add is that I'm looking forward to disseminating basic news which is relevant for consumers. We'll avoid all the mergers and acquisitions and the large company frauds and all those kind of things. We'll just keep it to basic issues which concern our ordinary consumers.
Inshallah, that would be great. But if there's a big fraud taking place, you need to let us know so we're aware of it.
Inshallah, most definitely. I'll find a way to all do that in a simplified way.
Okay, inshallah. Jazakallah khair for your time, and we hope to listen to you again next week.
Inshallah,
Ameen. Inshallah. Ameen. Well, there you have it, the finance lock called Conscious Consumer, and it's definitely, as the young people of today say, I'm woke because of what I just heard, and I'm really, really, you know, blown away by all of that information because it's something we never really think about, and it's good to have it at our fingertips. Quick break, and when we come back, inshallah, we're going to be talking about what's happening in Palestine, and inshallah, we're going to try and get hold of Osama Tamimi to speak to us with what's happened with Ahad Tamimi's brother Ahmed, who was in South Africa recently or last year sometime. He came in for surgery, and I'll quickly read to you what his medical team had to say after he was arrested on Monday by the Israeli Defense Force. So basically, they said Mohammed Tamimi underwent very complex an intricate surgery in October 2018 here in South Africa. This was done by a multidisciplinary team of specialist surgeons in order to address severe injuries sustained by a rubber bullet that was shot at close range into his face by an Israeli soldier. Plastic and reconstructive as well as maxillofacial surgery helped the facial soft tissue and bony deformity he had acquired by the trajectory passing through his face and into the brain. As these were technically very challenging procedures, the rehabilitation post-operatively both on a short and long-term basis required special care, delicate handling, and even modification of his day-to-day routines and environment. It is important that there should be no physical force, careful treatment of his post-operative scars, and of course a stable and calm emotional environment if full healing is to be achieved. It is with much concern that we as practitioners hear about this young patient after such involved and lengthy surgery being subject to repeat trauma, both physically and emotionally, and being removed from his family. We appeal to the authorities to please allow this injured patient to return unharmed to his family, to do whatever possible to prevent hurting him further, and to consider that he has already been so severely hurt before, and thus to exercise all consideration and humanity toward him. This statement was made by Dr. Ridwan Mir, Dr. Jamil Desai, Dr. Hizab Muqaddam, and Dr. Colette Smith, as well as Sister Erna van Veek, the team that helped Mohammed Tamimi whilst he was here in South Africa. And I think that's an appeal that many people would make if it was their child anywhere across the globe. It has nothing, you know, to do with the fact that he may be from a specific place, but inshallah, let's talk to his family, inshallah, now. But we take a quick break so we can get a hold of them. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Well, we're going to go right into it. As I was saying earlier before the break, Israeli forces detained the brother of Palestinian resistance icon Ahad Tamimi in a raid on the occupied West Bank on Monday. Nariman Tamimi told media that an Israeli force raided her home in the village of Nabi Saleh near Ramallah and arrested Mohammed. Nariman says that by arresting her son, the Israeli army is trying to break the will of her family. Well, we've got brother Osama Tamimi, he's the cousin of Mohammed, on the line, and inshallah we are going to have a quick talk with him just to find out how Mohammed is doing. So brother Osama, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, how are you?
Wa alaikum salam. Alhamdulillah, I'm good, and you?
Alhamdulillah, we're good.
You know, there's always such optimism from the Palestinian people. It's amazing. It really amazes me every time I speak to a Palestinian how optimistic you all are. But let me first ask you, how is Mohammed? Do you know, has anybody been able to visit him? And how has he been coping after the surgery, having returned home?
He was recovering well. But the situation here in the village was not allowed because he was basically chased for a long time. And they eventually got him 2 days ago.
Yes.
On Tuesday. He's now, today he have a court, but usually court, we don't really know what time they are.
Okay.
So
it's a waiting game.
Yeah. They raided his house at 2:30 in the morning. They've beaten his family. They sprayed spray on them. They scared the children. They brought them all in a room, and they took him from his, like, they came and woke him up.
Yeah.
So we're still not sure how the court is going because the family is still inside, and
okay,
you don't know what's going to say.
Yes, what's happening at the moment. All right, so, yes, I can imagine it must be quite, you know, horrible to sit and wait and know, wanting to know what's going on, what his fate will be.
Yeah, it's stressful this time because we have no idea what are the charges or we have no idea why he is in jail and this
yes.
court will determine everything. So,
all right, and
yeah, it's stressful moment for us.
Yeah, but health-wise, how has he been doing?
He was recovering well after he came back from South Africa. He's actually much better than before, but he's good. But until I think that's why the reason they arrested him, because they arrested him three times before, and his medical situation was not allowing them to keep him in prison. But now
they feel he's better now, so that and you know he can be incarcerated.
Yeah.
Well, that's really sad because, you know, like I was reading out the statement from the team that looked after him here in South Africa and the doctors who did the entire operation here with him. And they are worried because they feel that he needs more time to recuperate, to get better. So having him in this situation is quite worrying for them. And I'm sure that the family feels the same way.
Yeah, because he had some medicine and the Israelis didn't let the family give him the medicine or anything. So,
all right, so I watched about the situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I watched a little clip on one of the news sites where the arrest was actually taking place, and I heard his mom Nariman say to him, you know, what he should do. She was basically trying to lift him up, to give him confidence, and try to boost him so that he would, you know, not just give in to the police. And it was really heart sore to see this happening and to see how, you know, to hear her and putting myself in her situation as a mother, it really, really broke my heart to see this happening. So I can only imagine what the family is going through right now. And I'm hoping that, you know, we can create a more awareness of the situation and get more people here in South Africa to ask for, you know, him to be released from prison, because I don't think that's where he needs to be right now. And for all our listeners out there, what would you like to say to them?
I would like to thank South Africa because they played a big part in his life, for his surgery and his recovery, for our friend too. So I would like to tell them that first I'm happy that they closed the embassy in Israel.
The embassy, yes.
Yeah, so which is great news. And I would like to thank South Africa because they understand our struggle, because you've been through apartheid and basically that's the same what we're going through now.
Yes.
So
it must.
Yeah, I would like to thank them so much.
Well, you know, I think most people in South Africa are still trying to understand, you know, what's happening, especially the younger generation here. And I think that's where we need to take the message to the younger people of South Africa, because many of the, you know, the younger people haven't really gone through apartheid. So it's easier for people who have been through that to understand the struggles of the Palestinians. But those who haven't are the ones that we need to reach. And I think, you know, you, Ahad, Jenna, Jihad, as well as Mohammed, and all the younger people in Palestine have to reach out to more South Africans, the younger people here, and, you know, try and get them to see what your lives are really like. And I know many of them, especially the university students, get very involved, and schools, and a lot of people here understand, you know, what is happening or have an idea of what is happening. But I think the youth working together would be great in getting that message out to South Africans here. And inshallah, let's hope that we can do that. And we don't really have much time to speak because we did start the interview a bit late, and I do apologize for that. But what I would like to say from South African, or from my side, and I'm sure that many South Africans will echo this, is that we will definitely be keeping you in our thoughts and our prayers, especially Mohammed at this particular moment, and the family, because I'm sure it must be a very trying time for you guys. And we send our du'as and our salams to all of you, and inshallah the tide will change.
Inshallah, thank you.
Jazakallah khair for being with us.
Thank you.
And we hope you, you pass our regards on to Mohammed and Ahad and let them all know that they are definitely in our thoughts and our prayers.
I will. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Assalamu alaikum. Well, that was a quick interview, and hopefully we may be able to catch them again, you know, to find out more about what's happening with regards to Mohammed's incarceration. But from me, before I overstep my mark with regards to the news time, Jazakallah khair for allowing me to keep you company this Sunday morning. And inshallah, I hope to catch you again next week with another dose of edutainment at its best. Don't forget, you can send us your questions, gardening, finance, topics, suggestions, and your opinions on the show to 084-030-99. That's a number that you can reach me on if you would like to contribute towards the show or give me your opinions. Alhamdulillah, good or bad, it's good to know because then it allows us to grow and better what we offer to you. So for me, Jazakallah khair for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.